We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. And in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Haiti. In January of 2010, the country was devastated by a very powerful earthquake. In fact, it was the worst to hit the country in more than 200 years. It's thought that as many as 300,000 people may have died. It's a little over a year later. There are millions of people who are still living in temporary shelters, and very little rebuilding has taken place in spite of the commitment of billions of dollars in aid promised by the international community. In this hour of the show, we'll try to get an update on Haiti, talk a little bit about the rebuilding effort. And our guest for the program is Claudine Michel. She is currently a professor in the Department of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Grew up in Haiti, was educated there and also in the United States. She taught kindergarten and secondary school in Haiti and also was the producer of two television series that aired on national television in Haiti. And she's visiting here to talk on the subject, Haiti, roots of inequalities, the new social contract, and consideration for effective reconstruction. She'll be giving this talk this afternoon on the campus of the University of Illinois. This is an event in the MillerCom series. These are always open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. This takes place this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to stop by, you should feel welcome. Here on the program, questions, comments are also welcome. We do ask people to try to be brief, but anybody can call in. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk, that's the address, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, you should feel welcome to call. And thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. You know, one of the things that I'm interested maybe as a point to start, because I know that in as you have, you know, talked about what it is that interests you, a major area of your work has been to try to find ways to address or maybe correct misconceptions that people have about Haiti and about its history and about its people. So if I was to say, well, what are some of the major misconceptions people have about Haiti? What would you say?
Well, Haiti is seen as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. This is something we hear all the time. There are the misrepresentations about voodoo. If I take just the first one, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, it is sure that Haiti is indeed a very poor country. But the part that's not told is the very complex history behind this poverty, both in terms of international relations, the role of foreign powers in, you know, colonialism, imperialism, neocolonialism, neoliberal policies. So that's the story that's not told. And certainly there are responsibilities on the side of the Haitian governments, the many Haitian governments that we've had. But it's a very complex story that's not told. And those are some of the misrepresentation at the level of, you know, society and politics. But I also, I'm training education and I study Haitian voodoo, which is the religion of the majority of the Haitian people. And the misrepresentations about voodoo are enormous. Mm-hmm. Pat Robertson, right after the earthquake, went on the air nationally in saying that Haiti, the earthquake is a result of the pact that Haitians had made with the devil in 1791. and that's repeated everywhere. And the misrepresentations about Vodou are very serious. Vodou is a religion like any other religion, and it's a way of life for people. It's a way to have hope for the future. And they call on the African spirits to help them sustain life and help the community. And it's really nothing like what's depicted on the media in the West.
Yeah. His selection of that date, 1791, that's significant because that was the time when Haiti threw off French rule. And this was something that was a remarkable event in history, and certainly something that other people around the world, particularly enslaved peoples, looked at as a kind of inspiration. It certainly enslaved African Americans certainly knew perfectly well about what had happened in Haiti, and thought, I'm sure at points thought, could we possibly do the same thing?
Indeed, it's a very unique history, the history of the slave rebellion, and they did gather where they had this ceremony. That's the myth, that's the belief, at Bois Caïman on the night of August 14, 1791, and that was the start of the revolution when they say, no more. We will do whatever we have to do. We'll call on our African gods to help us, but we will free ourselves. And they defeated Napoleon's army, which had gone undefeated in the world. And it's also the only country that defeated the British and the Spaniard and the French. So a very interesting history. It was, you know, guerrilla type of war that lasted 13 years. And they finally became independent. The official celebration was January 1st, 1804. But the last French colonialists left on November 18, 1803. And as you said, this is a story of rebellion. It's a story of people having this will that nothing would stop. It was liberty or death. Was very inspiring. It was followed by some slave revolts in the U.S., you know, Nat Turner and others. But it was also a story that was suppressed. People did not want the enslaved, the marginalized, the oppressed to hear about the Haitian Revolution. Thomas Jefferson, for example, you know, was not a proponent of letting that story be known. I was talking to a graduate student yesterday about education, because she mentioned some of the heroes of the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines. And I was telling her that even in after the Civil War and Reconstruction, when African Americans were legally allowed to learn how to read and write, the primer that the freedmen bureaus put together were prevented from having any mention of the Haitian Revolution and Toussaint Louverture in them. So, and even a larger story about 18th century, the French Revolution of 1789 and the whole Enlightenment movement in Europe. If there's the scholar, Susan Bourke-Morris, who wrote a very small book about Haiti, Hegel, and universal history, which is an extremely powerful little tool, where she really exposes the fact that these folks who are leading the movement of, you know, human rights and recognition of freedom in Europe, there's evidence that there were printouts in newspapers of the Haitian Revolution, and those people consulted those very documents, but the Haitian Revolution was silenced. They did not talk about it. And there's also this very important Haitian scholar, Michel Rove-Trouillot, who talks about silencing the past. It's one of our most important books in terms of really positioning Haiti in terms of it, how it started historically.
I think they're just forgive me for interrupting, but there's another part of the story that I think often doesn't get told, and the kind of disadvantage that Haiti had from the very beginning when the French said to the Haitians, "Well, fine, all right, we'll leave. You can have your independence, but
you're going to pay.
You're going to pay. There's going to be a price." And they demanded an enormous amount of money in reparations, something that I think Haiti maybe never really quite got over.
Well, you understand history. You understand. And indeed, Haiti is a poor country, but what country starts with such a heavy debt? It's the equivalent of what Haiti paid in the country finished paying the debt in 1947 is the equivalent of $21 billion. So imagine a country that's starting from scratch and then you're carrying that debt. And within that, Haiti, owed the money to France, but took loans from banks in France and the United States. So who's making money while Haiti's paying this debt that's unheard of in any other country's history, that they're paying a debt for reparation land lost?
And yet it's been more than 50 years since then. There doesn't seem to have been a whole lot of progress, at least since then.
No, but the story is very complex. In addition to, those things that we mentioned, there's a history of, slave rebellion, the masses of people taking over and getting rid of the ruling elite. So those stories were suppressed. There's the debt that you mentioned, but there are other factors also. The fact that Haiti was not just a nation that became independent out of a slave rebellion, but it was a black nation that did that. Okay, and Haiti really embraces its blackness. Being black in Haiti is serious business. Okay, in the Haitian constitution, it even says that if you were born on Haitian territory, you were black. Okay, so this little tiny small nation, standing up against those powers in the hemisphere. And again, we're looking at geographic location and what was happening, like during World War I, the German were really becoming very influential in Haiti. So when there was the American occupation in 1915, part of it was to basically prevent the German from taking over and getting a stronger base in Haiti. So it's a very, very complicated story. With the Dominican Republic, people say, how come they're way more advanced than you? They don't have the same history. They stayed with the Spanish colonization for a longer period of time. They did not have the destruction that was created by the war for independence. They didn't carry the blackness that Haiti carried with all those stereotypes that we were talking about at the very beginning. Haiti was an anomaly, something that really disturbed the Western world. Okay, and there is a very strong history of resistance in Haiti, a very strong history of, people really wanted to be free and knowing that they're a proud black nation. And that has not gone down too well with foreign powers. So there are all kinds of complicated stories. I keep using the word complicated and complex, but with the American occupation, during the independence, there was a alliance between the mulattoes and the slaves. And those two classes were, in with different phenotype, were trying to coexist with one another, with kind of sharing power, with the darker skin elite being more like the military route, and then the lighter skin people being more the public sector. Okay, so they were cohabiting and finding a balance. But then the American occupation came in and debalanced that. The army was dismantled. Okay, therefore, you had this group of, darker skinned folks who all of a sudden lost their power base. And five mulatto presidents were put in power one after the other. So a lot of destabilization. So even with the current situation, the foreign powers who have supported the Duvalier dictatorship for 30 years, you know, how can they morally justify that? Mm-hmm. So it's a very complex story. And Robert Faton talk about the political habitus, the pattern that the Haitian presidents get into. It's okay to come in and be dictatorial, authoritative. You know, that's how things have been done in the past. And, you know, those despots have been supported and, you know, often rewarded financially. So it's a very challenging story to tell. Mm. It's not simple. It is not point A to point B.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Claudine Michel, from the Department of Black Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. She's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk about Haiti this afternoon, and we're pleased that she'd come spend a little time with us. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to call. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, for a moment, to jump from the historical context to the present, in the last fall in Haiti, there was an election. And they managed to have the election in spite of the fact that they were still dealing with the destruction of the earthquake. There was a cholera epidemic. It was not an easy or convenient time, but they had the election. At least, you know, something like a million people or more, a million people actually managed to vote. There was a lot of unrest and protest after the election when the government said the top two finishers were the candidate backed by the current government, Jude Celestin, and a former first lady, Milan Manigat, that then said, now there's going to be a runoff. Well, people were very unhappy. The OAS said, no, we got a problem with this. And after a lot of pressure, the announcement was made that the government-backed candidate would drop out, mm-hmm. and that now in the runoff will be this man who's a singer, Michel Martelly, and Ms. Manigat in couple of weeks. It's
10 days.
The 20th, right?
The 20th.
Okay, yeah, 10 days. So one wonders, you know, given this the stability of the kind of patterns that you've talked about now for such a long time. This is a terrible way to ask the question, but does this election make any difference? Will things be any different afterward?
I think so. I think it will make a difference, and it will be a positive difference, even though, again, we saw the external forces having a role in this conversation, more maybe than they needed to. The current government, Préval, is really at fault for trying to basically place their candidate. Mm-hmm. I mean, place the candidate of its party. The two front runners are Mrs. Martelly, Mrs. Manigat, I'm sorry, and Michel Martelly. And with Mrs. Manigat, the baggage that she carries is really her husband. Okay, he was president for 4 months and did not do much, could not do much. What can you do in 4 months? Okay, but you know, it's like you were there already. People don't remember that it was 4 months. Anyway, she's an independent thinker, an independent party from her husband, and she has a program, and it's a good program. It's a good program. It's a sound program. She talks about education as being key. She also talks about teaching people to respect the democratic process as a mean, not just an end. It's like we want democracy. No, but it's every day. It's participation. It's inclusion. It's respect for the rule of law. So it's a very sound program. And I also find her quite realistic in saying that, don't think I can change everything in 5 years, but I can start the process. So I found her a very well-prepared candidate, someone who has 50 years of experience in government. And she's also a professor of law, a very ethical woman. So she's a good choice. If she gets in, I think there will be some, you know, changes in Haiti. And of course, being a woman, that's clearly a platform because Haitian women are very disadvantaged in mm-hmm. all this. And with Michel Martelly, I don't know him personally. I regret that somebody who's a singer would place his candidacy at this particular moment. He seems to be a good person who's done some good things for Haiti. He seemed to have a program about agriculture, but I do really see a big gap in terms of their level of preparation to handle the task and represent the country, not only internally, but at the international level. But people say he's not corrupt. People say he's independently wealthy, and we shouldn't be expecting the kind of things that we've seen in the past with those two candidates. The problem, Jean-Claude Duvalier was allowed by France and the U.S. and who else to return to Haiti. It was not a good thing at this moment. Okay, this might be a larger conversation about who can return when and what. But at a moment, just like you said, when we're dealing with post-earthquake survival, we're dealing with this cholera epidemic, and you throw in a former dictator in the midst of all this. And now people are talking about Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who still has followers in Haiti. But no matter what, he was not part of this cycle of election. So we don't need Jean-Bertrand Aristide right now in the midst of this conversation, because I'm hearing that the goal might be for him to arrive before the election. That would be destabilizing things. Mm-hmm. You know, whoever's in charge should not allow him to come in. And that's not a Haitian decision. We don't own the planes, and we don't, you know, let people out of the countries where they are.
When I saw that first story that Jean-Claude Duvalier had come back to the country after having been gone for 25 years, and then the fact that he has been charged with corruption and embezzlement. Some people thought that he essentially embezzled the country's treasury, you know, took it with him when he left. And I guess a lot of it has gone to his ex-wife.
Yes, indeed. 800 millions, I hear, that they left with. Yeah.
The first thing that I wondered when I saw the story about the fact that he had come back was why he would do that. I would think that he would have to have that expectation that people would not be happy to see him, and that they wouldn't want to do what they did. And why do you think he came back?
Well, to be fair to Jean-Claude Duvalier, this poor kid, I said, you know, inherited a country at the age of 19. And he inherited the bloody, you know, dictatorship of his father. But himself, Jean-Claude was not a bad guy himself. But he had no preparation. That's another example. He had no preparation to be president of a country. They stole all this money and live lavishly in France and the Riviera. The first day after he left, I remember there was a report that they were dining on lobster on the French Riviera. So a lot of corruption there. But I really think personally that this is a guy who's repentant, who feels very badly about the package that he's inherited. And he has no more money. People, former supporters of the regime in France, I understand, used to pay for his apartment. He has nothing left. So the man lives in poverty. And I think he was genuinely drawn back to his country. And it's almost like an act of patriotism to maybe say, you know, if I'm judged and if I'm, you know, sentenced, it's okay. You know, like going to the people. So I think genuinely missed Haiti, probably felt very guilty, extremely guilty about, you know, what the regime had done. And I think he may be ready to face justice if that's what's there for him. But he doesn't have, I mean, of course, a dictatorship that lasted so long has followers until now. But he doesn't have a message himself. He doesn't have a platform. The man can't do much harm at this point. Okay, whereas it's a very different story with Aristide, who was, you know, somebody pulling the strings from far, you know, away when he was first ousted and, you know, the second time. And he continues to be very active.
Well, that's another interesting question or a set of questions about Mr. Aristide, who also apparently wants to come back. He has been living in exile in South Africa, and that at some point fairly recently, the country, Haiti, actually issued him a diplomatic passport. But then there was this question of when he could come back. And I think that there were some complaints that perhaps the governments of both the United States and France were standing in the way of that, and that at the very least, what they want, they would prefer that he not come back before the March 20th runoff, for the very reasons that you state. And so one wonders, well, could he actually have a positive role, or would his coming back to Haiti be more of a problem than it would be positive?
It would destabilize things right now. Yeah. And I'm not a political scientist. I don't understand diplomatic relations. I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand court cases, you know, whether he'd be charged. I think all those things can be dealt with later. You know, as a citizen of Haiti, if he wants to return, they need to look at, you know, the rule of law, see where that fits, and make a decision. But at this point, even young college first year students could see that, you know, it would really destabilize things, because he does have, you know, a group of followers, and he has a message, he has a platform, and he's not part of this election cycle. He doesn't need to be there right now.
We are about at the midpoint here. We have a caller that we will get to in just a moment. Maybe I should introduce once again our guest, Claudine Michel. She is currently a professor in the Department of Black Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. Grew up in Haiti, was educated there in the United States. She taught kindergarten and secondary school in Haiti, also was the producer of two television series for children that aired on Haitian national television, and now more recently has been writing about Haiti and Haitian culture, has written about Haitian traditional religion, and is here visiting the campus to talk about Haiti. This is an event in the MillerCom series this afternoon, 4 o'clock, on the campus, Knight Auditorium, Spurlock Museum on South Gregory, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. Here on the show, questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone here in Champaign to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I've been following the events with some interest. And what I wanted to speak about was the United States government's interference in the internal affairs of Haiti, and why it was that the United States took upon itself the decision to remove Jean-Bertrand Aristide from power, and why they continue to refuse to allow Lavalas to field candidates for the presidency and for offices in Haiti, and why it is that the United States seems determined to prevent the people of Haiti from improving the quality of their lives.
Well, I see that as two questions. The last one being, why is the United States preventing the Haitian to improve the quality of their life? I see that as being separate from the Aristide question. And with the question about Aristide, there is no doubt at all that the way that a legitimate president was removed from its country while in power was totally, totally a violation of all kinds of rights, okay? It was totally wrong, no doubt about it, okay? And it's not the first wrong thing that the United States and others have done to Haiti. However, there is a current situation with the earthquake and, people trying to run an election. And as I just mentioned on the show, Aristide right now was not part of that cycle, and right, it would be a disruptive force right now. But on March 21st, you know, May 1st, once the ballot are counted, the man needs to be treated with due process.
Right.
Okay, so that's my position on that. I'm just saying right now we don't need any other crisis, anybody who can create any kind of disruption in the process. Please give us a chance.
All right. Actually, what I was curious to know is the fact that the United States has a very, very long history of interfering in Haiti. In fact, invading the country very early in the 20th century, and holding on to it for a period of time, and why it is that the United States has always continued to treat the people of Haiti with contempt and disrespect, the same way that France did when they were kicked out in 1804, And even Canada's joining in with the United States trying to keep the people of Haiti down. I have no idea why they do that or why they continue to do it. It just boggles my mind.
Well, we're on the same page, okay? But in some ways, I do have an answer, which is basically interest, financial, political, geopolitical. You know, I mentioned, for example, that they really didn't want the German presence in Haiti. There was the fact that they wanted to protect the Panama Canal, you know, with the 1915 invasion. And you mentioned a number of occupations. It has been 19 military interventions by the United States in Haiti. So, and I do provide some answers to that question this afternoon. I will be providing that. It's deep, deep, profound causes that continue to maintain the Western interests versus the interests of the people from the South, you know, from the island of Haiti, for example.
So the government wants to work on behalf of the corporations to provide a source of cheap labor for those corporations then?
You understand the story. Okay. You understand the story. Cheap labor, neoliberal policies, and,
Thank you.
You know, that gets at the question, or maybe we can go further on this question, because I would think, you know, when you talk about the interest of the of an industrial nation like the United States, you would think, well, Haiti doesn't have anything. What possibly could we be interested
Haiti,
in?
Haiti has cheap labor, okay? Way before, during the Duvalier time, they used to manufacture baseball balls. Yeah, it was, you know, when I was growing up, it's like baseball factories, you know, that they made the balls. And then after that, it became the garment industry, in particular Disney. You buy a T-shirt for $30 here, a sweatshirt, and, you know, some women got paid 5 cents to do it, you know, for a 14-hour day of labor. She gets, you know, $1.75 or something, and she has to pay transportation, and she goes home with like 80 cents. And I was telling a class just now about, you know, a class on women in the Caribbean. The woman may have a quota. In a film that the Center for Black Studies did with Mark Schuller and Wernie Bergen called Potomita, which means centerpost, the Haitian women as being the centerpost of the global economy. One woman says that her quota was 70 pair of pants per day, you know, that she had to produce. And for very little. So that's one part of the equation. The other part is Bill Clinton, interestingly, admitted that the issue of importing to Haiti rice from Arkansas really destabilized the agriculture in Haiti. Rice is the staple for food. And basically, this imported rice is sold cheaper than the rice that can be produced locally. Therefore, that destroyed the economy. And that was part of the people coming to, you know, this exodus toward the capital to try to come and get those factory jobs because, you know, their livelihood was challenged. And there was also the 1978, and that happened throughout the 80s, of the destruction of the black pigs, which were literally the pig banks of the peasant community. There was an epidemic of swine fever, and the USAID ordered that all pigs be slaughtered. And, you know, people could take a little piglet and sell it, and that was a way to pay for the school fees for a kid, you know. So a lot of things destabilized the Haitian economy.
And certainly the need to import food is relatively – there certainly would have been a time when the country would have been capable of and did produce enough food to feed people.
Until about a decade ago, it was, you know, only 20% being imported. Whereas right now, the issue of food sovereignty and food production is extremely crucial.
Yeah. And was that something that really has happened since the earthquake, or was that the case
That was the case before. This destabilization that happened with the exodus to the capital and the capital city, and that's why we had 3 million people living in a city built for 700,000, 500,000. So we saw the result. I mean, we don't control earthquakes, but what happened there was caused by poverty. The 316,000 lives or more that were lost on January 12, that happened because of the conditions.
There certainly has been a significant commitment by the international community to provide aid. At least they have said that they would be providing a certain amount of aid. I guess there's always a question of whether people will fulfill their commitments or not. And then what happens to that? I think it's the case that some of the money that's been provided already has actually ended up going toward debt relief and not really towards providing immediate needs to people.
Yeah, and the cost for foreign experts, which is giant, administrative costs and the actual cost to pay for the expatriate. I understand that some physicians in particular and other foreign expatriate get up to $1,000 a day while in Haiti. And very little has made its way to the people. In fact, they said that out of the 15% of the money that has been distributed, only 1 cent per dollar has reached the Haitian government. And with the people, you're talking about 40% of the camp, still a million people living in camps, 40% of those camps not having drinking water, 275 people sharing one little quote-unquote toilet, which is really like a hole in the ground. Really inhumane conditions that people are living in. And whereas the cost of products and everything continues to rise up, the cost of food, housing, even for people who, you know, were professionals and were able to rent, like this urban planner from Colombia, a Haitian, and we have very few women urban planners. She was paying $1,700. She took leave from her position as a faculty member to go help for a year, but she was paying $1,700 for her apartment in Haiti, and I believe they raised it to $4,000. She had to leave because there are people who can afford the $4,000. On the expatriates that side. And there's a lot of corruption there. That's the crux of you know, the current situation. Haitians not being part of the equation, Haitian not being consulted, Haitian being just puppet figures on committees, but the decisions are not being made by Haiti. And, you know, we are under occupation. And I have to say myself that I've had the privilege to participate in some relief effort with an organization called Direct Relief International, a small organization located in Santa Barbara. They do primarily health, you know, in medical supplies. They were the first one on the ground. But a small organization, I think, you know, in comparison to the Red Cross and the $350 million that they raised, and I understand that not a dollar has made its way to Haiti. But they had a community grant program for small grassroots local organization with a history of success in their community. And they, you know, asked the Center for Black Studies to serve as consultant for them. And basically, we have about 35 projects being funded with small cantinas for kids, small community clinics, even a woman who, you know, asked for funding to buy seeds so she could distribute them to both people who had migrated to the countryside and other families who had actually taken folks in. And, you know, that was a challenge for them financially. But orphanages, neighborhood schools, a radio program that talks about disability. We now have 10% disabled population. So formidable efforts by small NGOs, like the microbanking, Foncosé is another formidable force. But I can't be really, I mean, the list would be long. We're talking about 10,000 NGOs. So there are some good ones. But you also have, you know, the 3,000, 5,000 that appeared since the earthquake. And we call them the 5 days expert. They go to Haiti for 5 days. They see how they're going to climb up and get their next job. And they're on board having conversations. And because they feel entitled, they're arrogant. and didn't know what to say. They are managing to get their way through, you know. I've had an experience myself with a group of students that some faculty took with them to Haiti. And they really feel that they have the same expertise as people who have, you know, the black faculty and the Haitian professors involved. We have over 150 years combined of experience dealing with, you know, as professional in the field. But the 5 days seem to be enough for, you know, this group of people. And what's disturbing is that if it were an isolated story, but it's really a microcosm of what's happening. Mm. Folks who have the proper channel in the U.S., or with other agencies, and here they are, expert in Haiti, whereas the Haitian voices are not heard, and that's a story that's not pretty.
We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Claudine Michel is our guest from the Department of Black Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara, talking about Haiti. She'll be doing that in a talk on the campus later this afternoon. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about voodoo just as at the end here, just because it's something that you have done a lot of writing on. And it's one of those things at the beginning when I said, well, what are the big misconceptions? That's one of them. And this is one of there are a number of related religions that you find in the Caribbean that I think all one way or another ended up with people who had been taken from Africa, brought with traditional beliefs, then made something new with that. With influence of Catholicism, you know, other sorts of things, it ended up blended in and becoming this new thing. And Santeria is one of them, and Voodoo is another one, and there are some others. Yeah. What's the essential thing about that about this about Voodoo that you would like people to know?
This is such a broad question.
I realize that it is. I'm sure we could do a whole hour at least.
Yes,
just
indeed.
On
yes,
that.
Yes, indeed. But. Let me give an example. It was in the 16th century, Portuguese explorer goes to Africa and says, you know, those people that have no religion, I saw no cathedrals, you know. And indeed, you know, African traditional religion is a way of life. You live your religion at every moment of your existence. There is a close connection with the supreme being, God, and then you have the intermediaries. Okay, in the Catholic religion, those would be the saints. In the Voodoo religion, they are the loi, the spirits, and they preside over different realm of life. So you God is seen as too busy to be mingling in everyday affairs. So depending on the issues that you have, you actually consult that person and help, ask that person for protection and help. And you feed the spirit, okay, to invite mm-hmm. them to come. And that's why in a Voodoo ceremony, you have an altar where there are different foods, you know, to honor the different spirits that you're calling. But in terms of philosophical and theological base, it's really a religion like all other religion where people, you know, have belief in superior powers and they believe that there's a moral code of conduct and that there's a right path and that doing the right thing and being in conversation with those people, whether it's different forms of prayers. And for us, you know, the body is very involved in the religion. So it's dancing and singing. And if you do all those things, you're going to get protection. You're going to get support. And Voodoo is fundamentally a form of humanism where the human being is really central in the conversation. And I'm sure you know a bit about African philosophy, but it's about service to the human being. It's about service to the planet. Just like with the Native Americans, this is a big part of Voodoo, this close connection with nature and the fact that we are all interconnected, the unborn, the departed who often become the ancestors who become spirit and in the other world and look after the living. And Vodou is also a practical religion in the sense that you don't say, I am a Vodouist, I practice Vodou. You know, you just are taught things in the home, okay? You get up and you pour a little water, you salute the earth. You know, if you're eating, you feed the earth a little bit. It's a way of saying thank you. The Vodou temples are places where people take their kids for daycare. Vodou has certainly played a role in politics in terms of their communal organizations that understand the welfare, the well-being of the community. And when the community is abused, is not treated right, they get together and they act. Vodou has played an extraordinary role in Haitian art, which is one of the most beautiful art that exists in terms of color, vibrancy, shape, forms, connection with the outer world, you know, being in... So Haitian, with literature and education is one of my areas of expertise, where I make the argument that we have our kids in a school system that's very competitive, that's very westernized, and they fail. They don't do well because at home you may have five kids sleeping on the same bed and sharing every bit of food and everything that they have. And they walk into the schoolyard and they say, well, you can't talk to your neighbor because you're supposed to do your math by yourself. But using those communal methods of teaching and learning would really propel the education system. So we also feel that there are a lot of roots of democracy in Vodou, and so much could be done for the population if we really turn to, you know, took the time to really understand and respect those African roots and what they can bring to this black nation. That's an African nation in the Western Hemisphere.
And it's something that outsiders tend to misunderstand, to disrespect, to want to marginalize?
Indeed. You know, they want to talk about pins and dolls, which I've never seen despite all my years of, you know, field work. And, you know, I won't deny that, you know, some people have abused the religion. All religion have power, have energy that they can channel. But it's a small population. It's 1%, 2% maybe, like what you find in satanic cult, for example, in Christianity. So, it's really nothing like what the West has presented. And there are a lot of positive elements in Vodou.
And it's something that it sounds like it infuses culture to the extent that it's something that it's very deep, and that maybe, I don't know if it's something that people actually acknowledge, but it's something that is there and just it underlies everything, even if it's not maybe really obvious.
You understand. And you said we have a few minutes. I think we've had a wonderful conversation, and maybe I could end with a little Vodou prayer.
Sure.
Perhaps. And I was working on a preface of a book, very important book, Mama Lola, which really helped rehabilitate Vodou in terms of the Western Academy. By Karen McCarthy Brown. And I was working on that when the earthquake hit. And I said that it was a challenge to be writing about Haiti, the plentiful, Haiti, the giver, instead of the receiver of all kinds of charity. Haiti, you know, who's the holder of all kinds of wisdom, knowledge, and hope, you know, in the midst of this tragedy. And, of course, I talk about those moments of despair that we saw, but also the heroic rescues in the midst of this apocalypse. And of course, I go into the religion part where I say every society guards its ritual to bury the dead. It's something that we all like to do with dignity and respect. But in Haiti, many did not have even the luxury to identify their loved ones before they were thrown into public trucks and then tossed like garbage. Proper burial might have brought some minimal comfort and a modicum of healing and meaning to their losses. Yet even that was denied to the poor. Being able to honor lives that mattered to them, grieve properly, and have the luxury to remember. And I close the preface. Haiti is now sacred ground. Embrace the living, honor the dead, illuminate the triumph of the human spirit. Wete Monadlo. It's a ceremony that we do to remove the spirit who are believed to have gone underwater after a year. So this is the time when that ceremony takes place and the spirit are released to go back to the African land. So Wete Monadlo, let us open the passage of these souls to Guinea, Africa. Guinea is the realm of the unborn and the afterlife, where ancestors who have passed from this life to the next reunite with those not yet born, who are instructed with the knowledge of ancestral spirits and come into this world to share with the living what they have brought from the outer world, where the conjoining of spirits, old and new, creates a seamless tapestry of past, present, and future that is then brought to this earth to shield and strengthen the living. I hope that this conversation today honors this passage now, a year from now, 10 years later. Make way for the procession of the saints on their way to Guinea. Make way for the procession of Saint-Yo on their way to Guinea. Haiti is now sacred ground.
Claudine Michel. She's a professor in the Department of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and she's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. It's also the annual W.E.B. Du Bois lecture. She'll be talking about Haiti this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. It's on South Gregory in Urbana, and these events are always open to the public and always free, and you're certainly encouraged to attend if you'd like to hear more from her. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I appreciated your questions.